Group Meeting, Friday, 28 September 1984. Let me begin today by reading a couple of paragraphs from this book, The Heart of Religion. It's the beginning of the chapter on Krishnamurti. When time's discord bruises life, the light of heaven dims. Groping and crying in the dark, man sickens with fear and sorrow. Enfeebled, he cannot be wise or virtuous, but becomes the slave of authority, of the leader, the system, the ideology, the church, the book, the guru, the popular idol. Such authority loads him with the chains of creeds and beliefs, verbal vapors, and confines his life to the treadmill of custom and convention. Slaveholder and slave are wretchedly alike. Ignorant, dull, inept, emasculated. Neither can see that the worm-eaten staircase in their house of dereliction is no way to heaven. When the primal liberating vision of truth fades, man blurs life's fact with some foolish fiction. In strut the self-appointed stony custodians of this fiction, authoritarians who bandage your eyes and torture you if you say you are unable either to see what they assert you ought to see or to believe without question what you are ordered to believe. When at last the times decay and men groan for the lifting of the darkness, there arises one in whom the white-hot pulse of life bursts through and shatters the gloom. Springtime again, exulting in new creation. Be simple and see heaven's light enfolding earth, and hear time conversing with life, intoning timeless silence. Freedom from fear is indispensable for living the religious life. And as you all have, or at least most of you have already heard, I have said again and again that the religious life is the truly human life. The world as a whole misconceives the meaning of religious living. The world thinks in terms of subscribing to a particular faith, all too often without questioning it in any particular. And it subscribes to the following out of certain rituals and believing implicitly in various doctrines and dogmas. Most or all of these doctrines and dogmas are misunderstood by the bulk of humanity. Take a simple example like the Immaculate Conception. This teaching of the Immaculate Conception has been put forward not only in relation to Jesus, but also to Lao Tzu, to the Buddha, and various other teachers, Zarathustra, and various other teachers like that. Now, the Immaculate Conception implies that there is no element of concupiscence involved in such a conception. And the word conception in that context applies not simply to the human conception which results in a fetus, which results in another human being, but it really is concerned with the conceiving of one's own divinity. When a person lives the clean life, the pure life, morality in the finest and truest sense of the word, not something which is imposed upon you by authority or by custom and convention and so forth, but because you yourself see that this is the good way, the clean way, the true way of living, then there takes place an extraordinary change in your own mode of awareness with respect to yourself and to all human beings and to your entire environment. Now, when this mode of awareness changes, you become aware no longer confined to the context of the finite, the temporal, and the mortal, but you do become clearly conscious in terms of the infinite, the eternal, and the immortal. When you are clearly conscious in that manner, what has happened is that one's own limited consciousness is at home in the transcendent state, the transcendent consciousness. And because that emerges as a result of the pure, clean, true life, the human life, the everyday human life, it is an immaculate conception. We talk in terms like the Christ spirit is born in you, the Buddha nature has completely flowered out in you. It is there in potentiality. You may use any such term taken from any religion or mystical teaching or whatever it is. And that, to me, is about the real meaning of the Immaculate Conception, this transformation of consciousness from its limitation to the finite and temporal state to the infinite and eternal state. Now, this does not mean that the finite, temporal, and mortal is destroyed. Nor does it mean that one completely and totally leaves it alone. Whilst one is alive, that is the existential being, the psychophysical organism, what we commonly call the person, is alive, he must of necessity utilize his sensible awareness of the finite and the temporal in order to live in the world. It's no good being the sun with its wonderful sunshine if the sun is going to put a curtain round itself and so that the light and heat and life of the sun cannot penetrate anywhere. That is not holiness, that is not humanness. Because, as I have said so often, the word human literally means the happy, or if you like, the blissful creator. Now, this is something which is not usually understood or known, and of course it's very difficult in the ordinary way to accept such a statement. Because if I say that human means the blissful creator, I am saying precisely this. God is the blissful creator. But man has projected out of his imperfect brain, his imperfect mind, his not completely pure psyche, he has projected all sorts of conceptions of God which are completely tainted with his unevolved humanity. Look at all the God conceptions that have been put out. Every single one of them and everything that is said about God is only man apotheosized. I love, God is love. I am gentle, kind, helpful, truthful, beautiful. God is all that to the nth degree. Every single conception is like that. It'll be almost impossible to find, even in the writings of the greatest of the mystics, of all faiths, any statement about God which really transcends the imperfect human condition, transcends the context of the finite and the temporal. Now, of course, one can understand why this is so. All our language, every bit of it, is concerned, expresses, communicates only that which is finite and temporal. Things, events, ideas, insights, what are they all? They are all born of our experience in the world, of the world, and in the state of consciousness. This is the most important thing. In that state of consciousness, which is limited to the finite and the temporal. So, if I say human means blissful creator, it is like saying something which will shock the majority of human beings in the world. That human means blissful creator. It will shock them. because they think that only God is the creator. Far from it. There is no such entity as God. Absolutely none. The word God is a very nice word. I like the word as a word, principally because it is a monosyllable. It's so easy to say God. As easy as saying dog. Reverse the letters. It is an easy word to use. Therefore it has its value as such. But what does the word mean? What does it stand for? If we can see, not merely believe or merely think, but really be conscious of the fact that God, the word God representing the supreme transcendent, necessarily is that which is unknown and unknowable. Thousands of people through the ages, through the centuries anyway, have said, I must find God, I want to find God. You can't find God. Say to yourself, I want to find space. Well, travel through the cosmos shouting, I want to find space. It's like the fish in the ocean which said, I must find some water. What is water? The unknown and the unknowable to the fish. It's somewhat like that. We must recognize that we are aware, many human beings are aware that there is something which altogether transcends them. It is that sense of the transcendence which is altogether beyond and therefore by the brain unknown and unknowable, you see, is the meaning of the word God. So you can't talk of God in any glib way that the theologians and the philosophers of religion have written about God and so forth. You all know, I think, Hauss and Thomas Aquinas, when producing his Summa Theologica, wrote 12 volumes, mighty tomes. They are marvelous tomes. And he was intending to write a 13th. Now St. Thomas did live the clean life, the holy life, as we might say, the pure life inside himself. And he had the divine vision. They say in words and in writing, he had the divine vision. But what on earth is the meaning of the divine vision? What do you see? You don't see a thing. You don't hear a thing. You have utterly transcended all your senses. You have utterly transcended all your memories, your knowledge, your brain activity, altogether. But in a curious way, this transcendent consciousness, this sense of transcendence, comes to life inside you. And when it comes to life inside you, then you know that all that I have said and talked about God and all the rest of it is nonsense. And he never produced the 13th volume. One day a friend asked him, a close friend, about the Summa. And he said, it's all rubbish. That is what he said. Now this is extraordinarily significant, isn't it? You cannot give expression in terms of the finite and temporal of that which is the infinite and eternal. I know there are psychologists and philosophers and positive logical positivists and all the rest of them, which say that your assertion about the infinite and the eternal is just nonsense. You don't... Well, what is it then? Tell me. It is the untellable. But it is the... It is unstatable, but it is experienceable. Now that is the interesting part of the story. That you do experience the transcendent. If the conditions are right. That is to say, oneself has become pure, clean, fully human. Now, you know, the books on religion have said how God created the universe. In a sense, that is true. But the sense in which it is true is, I would venture to say, totally unknown to all who say it. They don't know what they are talking of. But it just happens that the words are suggestive of the actuality. Which means that within us, human beings, there is a divine potential which is coming to fruition throughout the entire human race, throughout the entire cosmos. It is coming to fruition slowly, slowly, slowly. But it is only man, at least as far as this planet is concerned, it is only man who can wake up to it. If he is interested, genuinely interested, prepared to examine, to challenge, to doubt, to experiment, and then if he lives the pure life, he may experience that transformation of consciousness in which the sense of transcendence really sparks up. And in that, something happens which he can never deny. And if he is one who has really, truly realized the actuality of the transcendent, he will not speak about it. That is to say, he will never say or write, I experienced this, that, or the other. You see, or the divine guides me, and so forth. He wouldn't do it. I know of several very great philosophers and religious people in India who have written in this strain. That's a mistake. They write that sort of thing or say that sort of thing in order that which they are starting in order to fulfill their spiritual ambitions can draw people to them over whom they will exercise authority and domination. So be very, very careful of such writings. Never go guru hunting, whatever you do. You see, as Krishnamurti once said, be allergic to gurus. You see? Now, to live the religious life, the clean life, the pure life, it is essential, absolutely indispensable, to be free of fear. All fears. Consider how and why some people, well-meaning, sincere, granted, well-meaning and sincere people want to live the good life. If they can look into themselves carefully, they will see that they are afraid of the consequences of living the opposite of the good life. I don't want the tortures of hell. Therefore I shall live the good life and at least avoid the tortures of hell. I would like to be in heaven. Now see all that is involved in these ideas. First of all, survival. We think that this material, physical body perishes, but some mysterious soul or spirit or whatever you like to call it, is immortal and continues afterwards. How do you think the idea of survival ever came into being? Nobody seems to have challenged that. I suggest it came into being, at least this is part of the reason, because of dreams. In the evolution of man from the higher primates, after the Homo erectus stage, there came archaic Homo sapiens. His brain capacity was some 700 or 800 cubic centimeters. So he had some brain. He had considerable brain, in fact. And there were tribes, and the strong man was the leader of the tribe. And the tribes were often at war with each other for territorial reasons or for obtaining over a mate or whatever the reason was, you see. And A slew B. A little later, A had a dream in which he saw B. And curiously enough, you know how it is in dreams. You may all have yourselves experienced this. In dreams, your limbs have lost their strength. Your legs can't run. You can neither hurt the other person or run away from him and so on. I have myself, for instance, dreamt. I have not slain anybody. But I have myself dreamt of seeing a lion at very close quarters. And I can still remember the sense of fear. I don't now anymore. This was in my young days, before the last war. You see, I realized that I am absolutely helpless. Now, this fellow who dreamt of his slain enemy, against whom he was completely helpless in his dream, and others must have felt the same. Others must have experienced that, and they must have. Talked together about it and said, in some mysterious spirit form, non-physical spirit form, that chap whom I slew survives. I think that is probably, very possibly, a way in which the idea of survival came. And then, once having got hold of spirits as such, we are tribes, and they must have tribes of spirits, and the chief of the tribe of the spirit must be a super spirit, and their supreme super will be God. This is how the idea must have come. But you see, it is entirely a projection out of the human brains of people who have never realized transcendence in itself. This is how these ideas come about. So, I want to go to heaven. I am afraid of hell. Then much later on, just because the big chief gave rewards to his faithful followers and those whom he liked, and punishments and perhaps destruction to those whom he disliked, God does the same. So there's a judgment of the spirit after death, and either you're chucked into perpetual torment, or you're pushed into a perpetual felicity. How on earth is it possible for a finite, limited human being so to live as to produce an infinite result? Can't do it. Now you see, I have repeated this two or three times since last September. But it is very important for us really to see this. See it so clearly that we are completely conscious of it. And if we become completely conscious of all this, you see, and cast aside and be free, like the healing body gets free of all the scabs on the skin. They fall off, you see. All these scabs, these mental, psychological, spiritual scabs will be out. And then you'll be free. You'll be free in your inner consciousness, innermost consciousness. And that freedom will spell a complete freedom, not only from fear, but also from sorrow. That freedom will also make us see clearly that what we call the body is the totality. All that we call transcendent, infinite, eternal, immortal, all that we call finite, temporal, mortal, is all crystallized in each living creature. It's all there. Questions like, what happens after death? What will happen to me? Etc. All those questions are meaningless questions. And when you really see that they are meaningless, not take it for granted because I said it or you read it somewhere or some authority pronounced it, but you see it for yourself, then you will have emerged into your true humanity. And I say your true humanity, your true blissfully creative condition, because such seeing, such transformation of consciousness is identical with doing. Whatsoever you do then in life, in the ordinary way, in our everyday life here, whatsoever you do will be touched with that transcendent power of creativeness in it. And you will find that it is impossible not to be happy under those conditions, because there will be an extraordinary serenity. Nothing will upset you. I have had proof of that only quite recently, even with what little I have seen. When Sylvia had this massive heart attack, I was perfectly quiet inside. Not the slightest disturbance. The same thing happened last year, you know, when she had that first heart attack. It's like that. When you get this serenity, this imperturbable peace inside you, then you will find that you're going to live a wonderful life and do wonderful things. Now, it is necessary to be free from sorrow also, because all sorrow is rooted in separate self-consciousness. Isolative, separative self-consciousness. I am not this, that and the other. Which is quite absurd really. Of course all the world will say this man is crazy. Of course the bodies are separate. We can see they are separate. We can touch each other and know that they are separate and all the rest of it. But if you can begin to see in the light of transcendence, you will find that the idea of separation, of isolation, is a completely nonsensical idea. Since infinity, eternity are embodied in this manifestation in terms of the temporal, of the finite and the temporal. Therefore, actually, the finite and temporal is the nexus, the focus point for the reception of that which is infinite and eternal. You see? It's like, you know, we are like a receiving set. You press this button and you receive such and such vibrations. Press that button and you receive others, and so on. It's somewhat like that. And when you are like that, it is possible to be in right relationship with anything and everything. And anything and every phenomenon, phenomenal aspect of our psychophysical life will find the right expression. X will not run away with Z's wife or some such nonsense. There is a right relationship between man and wife, between friend and friend, between brother and sister, between each other. And that right expression will inevitably, naturally, spontaneously emerge out of you if this transformation takes place. And that will be human living. I mean, all these attempts at establishing societies or society for the prevention of whatever you like, you see, and so forth, the society for promoting this, that, and that. It's all nonsense, you know. Up to a point, yes. But you will find that. And, mind you, although I say up to a point, yes, I do mean that if something does seem to you at this moment that this is the good thing, the right thing, do it. Don't avoid it. Because you see, we cannot overreach ourselves at any time. It's no good trying to play God or play at being a saint. It's utterly impossible. That's why this sort of idea, oh, I'd like to tread in the footsteps of the Master, it's so utterly stupid. You can't follow in the footsteps of the Master. The footprints of the your footprints are utterly different from the Master's footprints or from your neighbor's footprints. You can't tread in other people's footprints. Each one of us is absolutely unique. This is the marvel, the miracle of the infinite and the eternal, embodying itself in the finite and temporal. The variety is absolutely incalculable. Everything has to come to fruition by itself. Whether it be an atom or a virus, a microbe, or whether it be a cosmos, or whether it be a saint, or whatever you like. You see? So, be happy. In fact, you will be happy doing it. If you think joining this society and working together with them is the right thing to do, do it. You see? Because that is what you actually see at this moment. That's why it's important. But be watchful. You know, Jesus said, watch and pray. For you know neither the hour nor the day when the Son of Man cometh. The Son of Mind, of pure mind, the universal mind, the divine mind. It flowers out in you. The Buddha said, Samasati, Samasamadhi, perfect watchfulness, perfect mindfulness, and Samasamadhi, perfect communion. Samadhi ordinarily means being concentrated in mind. That's a poor meaning. Samadhi to me means the supreme togetherness, which implies omniscience. But omniscience doesn't mean encyclopedic knowledge at all. The founders of the great religions couldn't do an A-level. Not a single one of them could have got through a modern A-level. But they had realized transcendence, which I don't suppose there is any A-leveler who is capable of realizing transcendence. In realizing transcendence, they had realized perfect humanity. They were perfect humans, the first fruits of the whole evolutionary process which has brought forth the human race into being. And in being happy, you will inevitably do what is good and what is right. Because if you do wrong, then you will cease to be happy. But the truly happy state, this inward serenity, this utter imperturbable peace, which will be there. And that is the true objective of yoga, yoga in the true sense. Unfortunately, yoga, when it came to the West, on the whole, has just become a keep-fit, money-making system. The green goddess will keep you fit every morning on TV. Absolute nonsense. Why should you care for the body at all? Because this is transcendence embodied. It is holy. It is sacred, this thing. Look how people use their bodies in the world. Look at one of the worst examples of it, apart from the people who just drink themselves to death and all that sort of nonsense. Those who go breaking athletic records and so forth, forcing the body quite beyond its normal powers. What for? To get a lump of gold. What sort of an evaluation is there of the living body then? You see? I don't think any sports club will admit me as a member. But certainly play games. Play, be athletic, all this is useful. Practice the physical part of yoga, very useful, very good. All in its proper place, in its proper proportion. That is the whole thing. Now, I wish you all the happiness and the peace which comes out of living the good life. But you must see what is good for yourself. Don't believe anybody else. In these 22 years I must have said well over 1,000 times in these meetings, don't believe a word I say. Consider it. Consider it and see for yourself. It's only what you see for yourself that will be effective for you and bring the right sort of result. And don't predetermine the result. Don't predetermine it. Don't wish this were otherwise. That is one of the foolish things we do, wishing something is otherwise. It is what it is. It is the inevitable and natural result of all the forces at play which brought it into being. So, let me work it out. See, and if you are yourself ahead of it, you will know what sort of action or word or thought is necessary from you in order to bring it to perfection. And that's all. spoke that. And if each one of us can truly renovate himself or herself, we shall renovate the whole world with it. One may say, but good gracious me, throughout the last 6,000 years, so many saintly people have lived, founders of religions, mystics, this, that, and another, and look at the state of the world today. And yet the consciousness of the world has undergone considerable change. Just at present, we are in a difficult state. We are going through a stormy condition. You see, but all storms come to an end. There's not a single storm which lasts forever. They all come to an end. And you and I, we are the instruments through whom peace can be brought into being. Because whatever I am truly conscious of affects your consciousness. And whatever you are truly conscious of affects my consciousness. Consciousness is a whole. You see, our fundamental error, I am I. Yes, in the baby state, I am I. But if I become a truly adult human, I am the totality. Not to be understood in any sort of megalomaniac or all that sort of sense, but the actuality is like that. So, if we renovate ourselves, then we become powerful instruments naturally and spontaneously to renovate the whole world. And I'll leave you with that thought tonight.